Hello, and welcome to the Salisbury Pediatric Associate Health and Wellness Newsletter. I'm your host, Dr. M, and this is Volume 14, Issue Number 8. This happens to correspond to the week of February 5th, 2024. So this week, we're going to look at some literature and review some recent publications. We're going to talk about the experiment related to continuous glucose monitoring, and then a third topic on play through the lens of Alison Gopnik's new book. The free thoughts this week. For me, unstructured play coupled to clean air, clean water, and clean food clearly is the route to have a well-adjusted and healthy child. Those are some of the things that I think about in my day-to-day ponderings of life. And we're not doing a great job with giving our kids clean air, clean water, and clean food, as well as having unstructured outdoor play. We're doing actually a pretty bad job there. So something to focus on moving forward. I wish the government would get involved in a positive way in this space, but alas, that is what it is. Okay, so in the newsletter, I posted the psychopathology diagram that sort of the pathway that Dr. David Clark had given me permission to post that sort of gives you an understanding of the effects of adverse childhood events in the context of physiologic symptoms and therefore physiologic disease that we see of as true disease. So worth a review. Go to salisburypediatrics.com to the newsletter Health and Wellness tab, and you can see it there. So the literature review. One, cancer is now a unique risk factor for cardiovascular disease, according to recent research. This being discussed as a point of emphasis for those that have been diagnosed with cancer, as the knowledge is a wake-up alarm to the biological underpinnings of the disparate immune-based diseases. This comes to us from Melchiori, M-E-L-C-H-I-O-R-E-R et al., and that's in 2023 in the journal Circulation. So for me, this is pretty simple. If you have a strong family history of cancer and or heart disease, as I do, this data needs to be understood from the prevention lens focus. In a few weeks, I will be discussing APOE genotyping and how that relates to disease in general. But suffice it to say that the underlying bioimmunology of cancer and immunoinflammation are not that far apart. So having one is sort of not strange to have the other. Number two, in a translational model, sulforaphane increases mitochondrial biogenesis, which is a critical factor in age-related mental function, especially memory. Shimizu S. et al. 2022 from the International Journal of Molecular Sciences. What are we talking about here? So sulforaphane in and of itself comes from broccoli, broccolini, sprouts, leafy greens, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, and other similar leafy vegetables. Sulforaphane is very important for increasing the action of NRF2, and as well as being an antioxidant that neutralizes mitochondrial free radicals. NRF2 in and of itself is an activator of our cellular defenses, which means that it is intimately involved in our species' longevity. NRF2 is at the center of the science of environmentally derived oxidative stress and the human mechanisms cells use to counter it. Sulforaphane is the most potent plant with the capacity to activate NRF2, inducing gene transcription within our cells, regulating much of the cell's defenses. Thus, it behooves us to pull on this lever for cellular solvency, immune-wise, and long-term health. Now we can add this new mechanistic data to our understanding of its use. Memory and mental health over our lifespan is enhanced by the consumption of these plant-based foods. So remember, sulforaphane comes from all the brassica-type vegetables, the green leafy vegetables, and more. For those interested, NRF2 stands for nuclear factor erythroid 2 related factor 2, which in layman's terms, mean erythroid red blood cell, nuclear factor, it's a factor related to function inside the red blood cell. And it is a transcription factor that regulates many, many, many different cellular defense and oxidative insults in our body. So, number three, vegan versus keto diets for immune responses. Nature Medicine has a new 2-week crossover study that is interesting. From the paper, quote, nutrition has broad impacts on all physiological processes. However, how nutrition affects human immunity remains largely unknown. Here we explored the impact of a dietary intervention on both immunity and the microbiota by performing a post-hoc analysis of a clinical trial in which each of the 20 participants sequentially consumed vegan or ketogenic diets for 2 weeks. Our data revealed that overall, a ketogenic diet was associated with a significant upregulation of pathways and enrichment in cells associated with adaptive immune system. In contrast, a vegan diet had a significant impact on the innate immune system, including upregulation of pathways associated with antiviral immunity. Both diets significantly and differentially impacted the microbiome and host-associated amino acid metabolism, with a strong downregulation of most microbial pathways following ketogenic diet compared with baseline and vegan diet. Despite the diversity of participants, we also observed a tightly connected network between data sets driven by compounds associated with amino acids, lipids, and the immune system. Collectively, this work demonstrates that in diverse participants, 2 weeks of controlled dietary intervention is sufficient to significantly and divergently impact host immunity, which could have implications for precision nutritional interventions. This comes to us from Link V et al. In Nature Medicine 2024. So I look at this as the beginning of many tests or many studies to come to look at nutrition globally as it relates to host immunity and the microbiome. This study is of value only in that it shows a differential response. We need more data to show that these differences are clinically relevant over a continuum of time, leading to better health span and better longevity and better lifespan. However, it is likely to be so over time. We shall see whether that actually turns out to be the case. There's nothing else to see here, just sort of interesting that now we're starting to get this kind of data. Article number 4. Obesity drugs have signs of reducing inflammation, according to Nature News. They write, quote, in one experiment, a GLP-1 receptor agonist called liraglutide alleviated liver inflammation in mice with a fatty liver. A similar effect was observed in the pilot study in people. In other experiments in mice, liraglutide demonstrated anti-inflammatory potential in the kidneys and the heart, and GLP-1 itself reduces inflammation in fat tissue in obese and diabetic mice. Quote, we know from animal studies and human studies that GLP-1 seems to reduce inflammation almost everywhere, end quote, says Drucker. The reductions in body weight and blood sugar that the drug triggers probably help to control inflammation, but some of the drug's anti-inflammatory effects start even before meaningful weight loss is achieved. This is why scientists think there's a separate mechanism at play here, end quote. This comes to us from Lenaro M. et al. In Nature News 2024. The research actually is in animals, primarily translationally, but these are the beginning looks at the diverse mechanisms related to GLP-1, glucagon-like peptide 1, function from an exogenous source, an outside source. These drugs will be watched carefully for side effects as the positives appear strong in select groups, especially those with obesity and metabolic syndrome. The cost is quite a problem at this point as well, as a small but real risk of pancreatitis and hypoglycemia and other issues, lean body mass loss. Nothing is ever that simple as, yes, drug equals great outcome. Article 5. In Nature Reviews Cardiology, Dr. Rauber, R-A-U-B-E-R, published a comment on ultra-processed foods and heart disease. Ultra-processed foods are ANOVA classification 4, which means that they are far away from the original food form. They've been multiply processed over time. They are often exposed to preservatives, colorings, flavor enhancers, additives like emulsifiers, and much more. These alterations were never well studied in humans before being summarily released into our food supply, especially that of our children. These foods are often subjected to chemical reactions to enhance flavor, shelf stability, and consistency. These foods have been increasing exponentially since the 1990s and make up close to 60%, 6-0, it's unbelievable to think that's the reality, 60% of the diet for many Americans, especially in children again. This is a major conundrum facing our society. The totality of the evidence to date states that the consumption of ultra-processed foods and the volume consumed has a direct effect on the risks of cardiovascular disease, and in my mind, after all the other studies we looked at, metabolic syndrome in general, which leads to high blood pressure, cardiovascular dysfunction, diabetes, obesity, and many other problems. So, yeah, I would encourage you to go read the actual entire comment, Nature Reviews Cardiology, Dr. Rauber et al., 2024. Go Google it, read the entire one. It's a clear analysis that's troubling and scary as far as I'm concerned. Section 2, blood sugar response. So I was in round two of this continuous glucose monitor experiment. The first one that I did was a couple of years ago. I used the Abbott, A-B-B-O-T-T, Libre device. I learned a reasonable amount from that experiment. However, I found that the accuracy of that continuous glucose monitor, or CGM, was very wide range, from 5 to 40 milligrams of deciliter off from the original finger skin stick test. It was still very useful to understand what drove high blood sugar spikes over time, but the tightness of it was a little bit annoying. This time around, I used a Dexcom version 7, which I found to be much, much, much more accurate. This meter seems to have a much tighter range, being around 10 milligrams per deciliter differential from the finger stick, mostly high, but sometimes low. But it was definitely way more accurate. On the two-day cycle, when I published this at that time, I had one big massive blood sugar spike following a dinner meal that I attempted to see what would happen if I consumed a large box of pasta. And then I also had fat and carbs associated with it. So the dish was baked Brussels sprouts with bacon bits, cassava pasta, a big amount, and miso glazed black cod fish. The kicker was, you know, there was some extra pasta left over with olive oil and some salt and pepper on it, and I really did cancel the whole box. A lot to say. So I consumed roughly 4 servings of pasta for the average human. Way more than I should have, but you know, I'm an interesting guy to begin with when it talks to how much I eat, but it was an interesting experiment to nonetheless to see what happened. So I watched the trend in my blood glucose readings in 5-minute increments, which is what the CGM does. At the start of the meal, the blood glucose was around 88 milligrams per deciliter, perfectly normal for a fasted state. Over 40 minutes, it climbed to 126, and then I went for a walk with my wife, Nicole, and my rescue pup, Charlie. It dropped to 110 at the one-hour mark after the walk. Then during the rest phase that followed, over the second hour, my blood glucose jumped all the way to 196. That was at the two-hour mark. Following the data out until it normalized, it took until 12:21 a.m., where it hit 88 again. That's a five-hour blood glucose level higher than I would like. For the remainder of the day, the measurements were sitting between 85 and 110 until the a.m. 45-minute run lift exercise that I did, which spiked it to 145, which is expected during vigorous exercise. Immediately returned to 85 before the first meal. Breakfast included 1.5 servings of granola with fresh strawberries and a cup of flax milk, a can of wild caught salmon with some mayonnaise, a large meatball with some red sauce, a salad with microgreens, one red pepper, and a half a beet, all washed down with some black coffee. The end result was a nice gradual climb up to 141 at 70 minutes postprandially, returning to 86 by the second hour. What is a take home? Even with excellent whole food diet and lots of exercise, the body's ability to handle such a glucose starch polymer load is humbled. The answer is not to consume 4 servings of pasta ever, even if you were testing it, sort of interesting, and keep those flour and sugar-based foods at bay. I highly encourage everyone to try a CGM on themselves and look for patterns of metabolism derangement in order to help you change behavior. Remember that your metabolism is unique. You are an N of one. Your microbiome, how your food goes into your body in order, like if you drink a sugared beverage first versus eating some protein, it's going to dramatically change how your blood sugar spikes, how your insulin resistance is in play or not in play. All these things are going to be important to pay attention to. Ideally, you should pay attention. Section 3, Alison Gopnik and her book. Again, I love this book, The Gardener and the Carpenter. So in her book, the focus is on the concept of play and its crucial role in the development of children. Dr. Gopnik explores how play is not just a leisure activity, but a fundamental mechanism through which children and animals learn about the world around them. The various aspects of play have evolutionary significance and contribute to creativity and problem-solving skills in children over time. There is a logical emphasis on the importance of allowing children the freedom to engage in unstructured play, as it fosters cognitive, emotional, and social development. Siblings and friends are especially adept at learning through play. They learn the ways of things through trial and error. Only children and isolated children often lack these necessary developmental skills. So, family with just one child will likely have more problems navigating social arrangements. Social media and screen exposure are now sapping our youth of this innate ability to be socially interactive with others, and that's a problem. Dr. Gopnik defines play as what you do when you're not trying to do anything at all. I could not agree more with that definition. The scientific evidence to date supports the full unadulterated expectation that children should play and play often. They should learn to self-resolve conflict where possible, only calling on parents when necessary. The three major types of play, rough and tumble, pretend, and game play all have merits for children's learning as shown in experimental models of humans and animals. The pretend or imaginative child has a distinct advantage in the theory of the mind or the ability to understand what others are thinking or want. Theory of the mind is a cognitive skill that allows individuals to understand the others that they're in relationship with and how they have thoughts, feelings, and perspectives different from their own. This aspect is crucial for an ability for social interactions and often defective in children with autism spectrum disorders. Allowing pretend play and imagination to flourish is a net positive for a child, full stop. Other interesting parts of this chapter include the fact that children are more apt to figure out many different aspects of a toy's function if left alone to explore versus being shown by a teacher. Alison Gopnik encourages a shift in mindset, moving away from a carpenter approach where parents try to meticulously shape their child's future to a more nurturing and supportive gardener approach which values the organic growth and exploration that play allows. Play is king. Get out there and play with your child. Explore, be, and thrive. Let it be unstructured. Don't always make it about something. Let them think, imagine, do. Just be in concert with them. Be in connection. Be in conspiracy with them as you enjoy the day together. All right. Again, I encourage you to read this book. It's a great one. I'm just picking excerpts randomly over this year, but it's a fantastic, fantastic book. Song of the day, Easy on Me by Adele. It's a good one. Give it a listen. All right, y'all. Have a great day. As always, the information provided in this audiocast and newsletters for educational informational purposes only and is not a substitute for advice and or treatment provided by your physician or other healthcare professional and is not to be used to diagnose or treat a health issue. It does not constitute formation of a provider-patient relationship. Have a great day.